So welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So today's date is June 16th, 2021. I'm here with my colleagues, Judge Frank Connolly and Judge Carol Hooten. We have four matters on our calendar today. Two of those are oral, and I see the attorneys are here by Zoom joining us for the first of those two oral matters, which I will ask the marshal to call. And then I'll make just a few quick additional remarks before we start the argument. So Marshal, would you call the first case? Please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Connolly, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfold presiding. Now calling A201125, State of Minnesota versus Tanya Nicole Williams.
All right, and again, welcome to both lawyers. We very much appreciate having you here today to argue your case. And I just want to remind you that although with the one novel thing today, or it's less novel now than it used to be, we're appearing by Zoom, everything else is the same with regard to our procedures. So although you see us on the screen and we see you on the screen, these proceedings can't be recorded other than by the court. And we do maintain an audio recording, which will be available on the website. Other than that, really everything is very much the same and we'll proceed in the usual manner. I know you're both familiar with our time limits. I will just remind you so that the recording is clear and accurate to identify yourself for the record, as well as the client you represent before you start your remarks. And then to keep your eye on the clock, which should be visible on your screen, because it tends to go quickly. So we look forward to the conversation. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Sharon Jackson. I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Tanya Williams in this challenge to her test refusal conviction. Today, I'd like to focus on the second issue in appellant's brief, and that is that Ms. Williams was denied her right to a fair trial by the judge's failure to give an instruction on the mens rea element of the offense, and also the prosecutor's misconduct in eliciting inadmissible opinion evidence on two of the offense elements, and the ultimate issue basically that the jury was to decide. Key to both of those arguments is the court's instruction on element five, refusal, and that can be found in appellant's brief on page 11. Now, like every offense, test refusal has both an actus reus and a mens rea element. The parties agree that under State versus Ferrier, the actus reus element is that the individual failed to provide two adequate breast samples, and the mens rea element is that the individual has an actual unwillingness to submit to testing or intends to frustrate the testing process. The problem with the instruction here is the judge combined those two, effectively eliminating the mens rea element or requiring the jury from finding that Ms. Williams actually had that requisite intent. If you look at the instruction, element five, as I said, on page 11 of appellant's brief, you'll see that within the definition of test refusal, the court instructed that it used mens rea-like language in instructing the jury on how to find refusal. And it indicated to the jury that refusal may be shown by a variety of factors, including, but not limited to, an unwillingness to comply or actions that would frustrate the test. That instruction did not require the jury to find both that the actus reus, that she refused, and also that she had an actual unwillingness to refuse. The instruction further reduced the state's burden of proof by tinkering with the language that Ferrier set out. Ferrier indicated that there had to be an actual unwillingness to submit to testing, but this instruction only required a willingness to comply. And a willingness to comply is a much less demanding requirement for the state. An unwillingness to comply, presumably that means with the officer's instructions or commands, could be shown by simply Ms. Williams' failure to blow precisely as the trooper indicated she should. The trooper told her she was supposed to blow into the machine like she would blow into a balloon. Under this instruction, that alone would be the requisite mens rea to find her guilty of this offense, when in fact, this court has indicated it there has to be an actual unwillingness to submit to testing. Now, the state doesn't argue that this didn't prejudice Ms. Williams, and that's because the record is very clear that this was an issue in dispute at trial. There was conflicting evidence as to her actual unwillingness.
Ms. Jackson, on that last point, I thought, and maybe I'm wrong, that, and I certainly agree with you, I don't think you should sort of tinker with the instructions, but I seem to recall, did not the, on that language that was added, I thought the defense attorney did not object. Am I wrong on that?
The defense did not object. That's correct, Judge Conley, and that's why we're arguing this under the plain air standard.
Right.
And
right.
If we meet the plain air standard, then the invited air standard doesn't apply.
And the language you're talking about is that last sentence. Well, I think that's what you just told us, is that last sentence that was added in element five.
That's correct. Go ahead.
No. I on the intent issue, was something taken out of the rest of the instructions on Ms. Jacks?
Nothing was taken out of the crim jig. What I would say is something was taken out of the statute. Ferrier makes clear that there is a mens rea element, and parties agree that that's actual unwillingness to submit to testing. And that is not in this instruction, separate from the actus reus of the refusal to provide the two adequate breast samples. So in that respect, it's plain error, and therefore the failure to object doesn't impact our analysis here.
Ms. Jack, just a quick, sure. Because I think you said this and I might have missed it. So are you saying that the crim jig instruction for this offense does not have the Ferrier definition?
It does not.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And it's particularly problematic in a case like this where there was a dispute of evidence on that element of the offense. Here, Ms. Williams did agree to testing. She did not verbally refuse. She provided breath into the machine to the extent that they were able to get a reading, although the trooper did indicate it was a deficient reading. He acknowledged that air went in. When he chastised Ms. Williams for not providing sufficient breath or for not submitting, she repeatedly said that she was trying to provide the test or her breath, that she was not consciously refusing. She indicated that perhaps the machine was malfunctioning. She indicated that she was blowing into the test precisely as she does with her interlock system on her car. So that was a disputed fact at trial that the jury, based on this instruction, never had to make a finding on.
Ms. Jacks, would you go back to your earlier argument? You were saying that you feel that actual willingness. Let's see. Make sure I say this correctly. Okay. Under the Ferrier standard, the actual
unwillingness
is not the same as the language that we find in this instruction, which is an indication of unwillingness. Is that your focus?
Any indication of an unwillingness to comply. So our focus is that it can't just be an indication, that there has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, one case that I would point the court to that wasn't cited in appellant's brief, but kind of gets to this point in response to your question, is State versus.
So you don't have a problem with the other part of the instruction saying actions that frustrate the testing process. You think that's consistent with Ferrier?
We do not. That is also problematic because it does not require an intent to frustrate the testing process. Ferrier makes clear there's a mens rea, a mental state that is required, and actions actions showing frustration that the individual is frustrating the process in some way certainly would be circumstantial evidence of an intent, but the court didn't tell the jury that they had to find that intent or the actual unwillingness. We're taking issue with the lack of that word intent. We're taking issue with the word comply as opposed to submit to testing, because complying is a lesser burden than submit to testing.
Would you agree? Would you have had a problem with the instruction if that sentence was not added?
We would still have a problem with this instruction because there would be no instruction whatsoever on the mental state. So if we just take that sentence out, so we have a problem with the crim jigs generally. is the bottom line.
I got it.
Yeah. If we take that sentence out, then we still have an instruction on the actus reus, but we have absolutely nothing on mens rea, and no jury would ever be required to find that mens rea.
Ms. Jacks, can I just, am I understanding you that your problem with this instruction, this one sentence, is that the word actual indication is not in there? The word actual isn't in there?
That's one of our many problems with it, Judge Hooten, but I would say that is probably of least concern to us. I do believe that lessens the state's burden somewhat because the word actual really emphasizes that the subjective intent of that individual must be there. But, you know, that is not the primary problem. The primary problem is that the two elements are all included in one element as given to the jury. And so the jury could have found actus reus without having found mens rea. It could have found mens rea without finding the actus reus. And to the extent they found mens rea, it isn't the mens rea required by Ferrier and the statute. It's a watered down version of that. And in this case, that really mattered because here, it wasn't just Ms. Williams' testimony. The exhibits of the actual testing were presented to the jury, and she states, she makes multiple comments throughout the testing procedure that she's trying and that she's not refusing.
Ms. Jacks, on that point, on the language, I mean, Ferrier does say refusal to submit to chemical testing includes any indication of actual unwillingness to participate in the test process. Am I right on that?
Yeah. I believe that's a quote from the case. And I would refer you, Judge Conley, to page 101, where the court expressly indicates that the actual unwillingness is an element of the offense. The court says on page 101, actual unwillingness to submit to testing must be proved, which means must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would say my reading of respondent's brief is they agree with that.
How would you prove that?
You would prove that through circumstantial evidence. All of the trooper's instructions to her and observations of her conduct. And is there evidence in the record here that would show that? Absolutely. But, you know, that's not the question. The question is, was it disputed and was there countervailing evidence, which there was?
Right. And of course, you would argue that that's all, those officer observations are all circumstantial evidence.
I believe that the officer's observations are direct evidence.
I bet you were really thrilled to see I was on this panel since I was on Stark.
Yes. Yeah. But I know that you're persuadable, Judge Conley. So I was not concerned by that.
Well, then you've talked to the wrong persons, Ms. Jacks.
Well, I'll just continue to focus on issue two then. Yes, I believe that, you know, there is evidence and we could see that there's evidence of that mens rea. The problem is we don't know if the jury found it or not. And that's because the instruction is wrong. And that means it affected her substantial rights and she's entitled to a new trial.
I hate to cut you off, but you do have your rebuttal. So let me follow up with one more question.
Sure,
so obviously we have to look at prejudice, and you've been arguing how it prejudiced the defense efforts in that was the central theory. Did she actually comply, or was she, you know, not complying and was frustrating? And so it seems like the relevant part of the instruction is okay, which is that, actions that frustrate the testing process is an accurate alternative way of proving refusal. I realize we're still missing the intent, and you've got that whole part of your, there's no direct reference to intent, but how does the state prove that actions frustrate the testing process without also proving intent, at least in this scenario where we have someone visibly complying, you know, putting their mouth to the device and going forward, not just verbally refusing. So I'm kind of struggling with their prejudice argument.
Yeah. The prejudice argument is, you know, and in our brief, we pointed to State versus Watkins. The prejudice argument is that the evidence isn't overwhelming. The element was in dispute. There was evidence presented on that particular element. And we can't look at the verdict here and say it encompasses this finding. It does not encompass this finding because the jury was never asked to find it. And I would say, you know, this is a little bit like State versus Makuk. Makuk was a case where the Minnesota Supreme Court reversed an aiding and abetting conviction. And it was the judge gave a similar instruction on aiding and abetting. The judge told the jury, you can find aiding and abetting in determining whether the defendant aided and abetting, you can look to things such as whether or not the defendant knew the crime was going to occur, whether or not the defendant intended their actions to further the crime. And the Supreme Court reversed and said, no, that is true, but ultimately the jury has to go farther and find beyond a reasonable doubt that those two things actually, that the defendant actually intended those two things. So we would ask that because Ms. Williams never had a jury find her guilt, because they never had a jury find her guilt on that element, that this court reverse and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. With that, I think we are ready to hear from respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. I plan to address the same issues that Ms. Jacks planned to. I realize most of the discussion focused on the jury instruction, and I expect that may be the case here, but I will try to go through the same issues that she was hoping to address this morning. And so getting started right away, I think appellant's argument seems to boil down to the difference that she perceives between the term actual unwillingness that this court provided in Farrier and that was included in the instructions in Noel, and then the word unwillingness that the parties agreed together to include in the instructions in appellant's case. And the mens rea that Farrier established does not come from the word actual, but comes from the word unwillingness. That's why this court, when it was describing that very standard in Farrier in its subsequent decision in Aldridge, described that standard without using the word actual.
Just a moment, counsel, just so you you know, fine-tune your argument. So I think the objection is to indication of unwillingness, which is a little different from what you're currently arguing.
But Farrier specifically says, as Judge Connolly was pointing out before in his question, any indication of. And there's really no way to meaningfully distinguish the argument that appellant is presenting in this case from the argument that this court rejected in Noel a few months ago. I mean, in there, again, they included that exact sentence that Judge Connolly just read back to Ms. Jacks involving, and I will get the words exactly right here as well, refusal to submit to chemical testing includes any indication of actual unwillingness to participate in the testing process. That was the language that was challenged as being an inappropriate way to establish the mens rea or to instruct the jury on the mens rea in Noel, and that's what this court rejected there. So if the focus of appellant's argument this morning is on any indication of, this court has already rejected that.
Well, what in this instruction do you think indicates that it has to be an intentional unwillingness?
I think the word unwillingness itself indicates the intent. I mean, that's the a common definition, as I understand, and the dictionaries understand, of the word unwillingness. It means without will, and will is the basis for, you know, an intent or a purpose to do something. So I think the word unwillingness itself satisfies the intent piece. And again, that's what this court found in Noel.
I imagine among the things Ms. Jacks would say is that just like Stark was unpublished and is terrible, so is State v. Noel.
So, I mean, I think you're looking for, you know, I mean, I will just be candid. I can't stand it when people add stuff to the jigs. I you know, half the time when people are up here, it's because somebody decided to do it yourself. And apart from whether the jigs, I mean, I know Ms. Jax doesn't like the jigs, period, but I hate it when people add stuff because it's just, I just think it causes all sorts of problems. I mean, why couldn't you have just, why couldn't the state have just, you know, rather than asking for that in the jigs, why couldn't you just argue that? Well, how would you find unwillingness? Well, you'd find it by, you know, she seems to be, you know, playing games. I mean, isn't your better argument that there was no substantial precedence because there prejudice because there's overwhelming evidence of guilt?
Without Noel being issued, I agree with that being a strong argument, Judge. And I think your point about toying with the instructions is really legitimate and kind of leads to a couple other things, which is that the standard here is plain error. And we have not the removal of anything from the pattern jury instruction. The entire pattern jury instruction was provided to the jury. There is this additional sentence, like there was in Noel, that, you know, describing what refusal can be. And again, that was taken from another decision of this court in Aldridge, just like in Noel, it took it from Ferrier. And I understand that Noel and Aldridge, going to Stark, if we get to that issue, are all non-precedential. But I don't see a reason for this court to be inconsistent with its own decisions merely because they are non-precedential. And I'm sure you feel that way with respect to Stark specifically. So in terms of the argument, I think that it a fine and acceptable practice would have been in this case to, in the closings, I take your question to mean, it's just argued what exactly it would have meant to refuse and kind of get to the fact that appellant demonstrated an unwillingness to participate in the testing process as Ferrier requires. And those arguments were made in the closing argument. I cite them in page 27 of my brief and footnote 12, where the prosecutor in closing pointed to the video evidence showing the numerous times during the 3-minute window that the Data Master test takes place that appellant was not physically blowing into the machine. And rather, you know, the video evidence also shows that during that same 3-minute window, appellant was arguing with the trooper rather than following the directions to blow into the machine for that entire 3-minute period of time. Another piece of evidence that was pointed out that shows intent is that the Data Master printout, which is an exhibit that was admitted into evidence that shows that the appellant did not provide a normal exhalation of air during that test. And as numerous cases from this court, including Ferrier, have pointed out, appellant never once complained to Trooper Utes about having any difficulty breathing or any physical inability that prevented her from providing air or blowing into the Data Master. All that would go to showing the unwillingness. So to the extent that even if that additional sentence that was taken verbatim from Aldridge was not included in the instructions the jury received in this case, because of the evidence that was the jury heard and because of the way it was argued in closing, I don't think there's any way that the substantial rights prong of the plain error test could possibly be satisfied by appellant.
Address Ms. Jack's second point or second part of her argument dealing with the trooper's testimony on whether or not her client's conduct constituted a refusal under the law?
Certainly. I think appellant misses the difference between the definition of refusal and the definition of great bodily harm that was addressed in Moore that she relies on. Great bodily harm has a specific statutory definition, and it's a mouthful. Bodily injury which creates a high probability of death or which causes serious permanent disfigurement or which causes a permanent or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ or other serious bodily harm. In contrast, when this court provided the legal definition for the word refusal in Ferrier, it relied on an everyday dictionary definition of the term. I'm quoting from Ferrier. To refuse generally means to indicate unwillingness to do, accept, give, or allow something.
Is test refusal a factual issue or is it a legal issue?
The act of refusing is a fact. It's that an element that needs to be established by the facts. And that's also, I think that brings us to another good point, Judge Shuten, because it's worth clarifying the questions that the prosecutor actually asked and what Trooper Utes actually testified to. Pointing to page 197 and 198 of the trial transcript, the prosecutor asked the trooper, what happened after that? And the trooper in response provided a lengthy description of what he personally observed appellant doing, and as part of that description stated, and based on her conduct at that point, I deemed it a test refusal, that she wasn't making any attempt to provide a breath test that day. I'm going to another point in the transcript that Ms. Jax highlights, page 263. In response to the question, was the graphical result produced by the data master considered a refusal under the law? And the response from the trooper was, yes, she, again, with my training and experience, she made no attempt to provide a valid sample as she was directed to. Now, Trooper Utes' testimony provided a factual explanation of what he personally observed in the context of that everyday legal definition of refusal. Again, an unwillingness to do. Now, this type of testimony is permissible under Moore. The trooper was not merely telling the jury what result to reach. Rather, he was explaining why he, as a firsthand witness, believed what he personally observed the appellant do, observations that appellant contested at trial, why that amounted to the physical act of refusing. Trooper Utes was not asked if an undisputed fact, for instance, the particular physical injury that occurred in Moore, satisfied a specific statutory definition. That's what was deemed inadmissible in Moore. I guess one last point I will make about refusal before and turning to the intent.
But I'd like to return to the point you just made, Mr. Petras. I mean, you know, that's an element of the crime. Mm-hmm. So since when do we let people testify as to their opinion as to whether an element of the crime has been met?
That's specific.
Go ahead.
I cut you off, Judge. Please finish. Okay.
No, go ahead. I've finished my point. Thank you.
Okay. I would direct you to Minnesota Rule of Evidence 704, which expressly allows what the prosecutor asked and what the trooper testified to, an opinion based on a personal observation and lots of experience that embraces an ultimate issue to be decided by the fact finder. Rule 704 is why any witness, an expert or a layperson, can testify, for example, in an intentional murder trial, that the witness saw the defendant kill the victim based on personally witnessing the defendant fire a gun at the victim. To kill is an element of a murder charge, which means it is an ultimate issue that is to be decided by the fact finder. But a witness is allowed to testify to what the witness personally saw happen. And that's true even if the defendant disputes that it was, you know, he challenges and says it wasn't he that caused the death.
Does the fact that this was a DWI situation change the analysis? Because, I mean, the trooper can find, I mean, the trooper has to determine whether there's test refusal or not, or otherwise he's obligated under the law to keep offering the test, isn't he?
He's not, I guess, required to limitlessly offer it. I think the statute.
But if he deems it's a test refusal, he doesn't have to offer it again. Am I correct?
I mean, it's if the jury finds that it was an actual refusal. Yes, I mean, in terms of being convicted for that conduct later on, in terms of what happened to Miss Williams, that is correct. Again, if that was. I don't guess see the difference between the jury's determination that there was a refusal and that and the officer's belief that there was refusal based on the conduct. Did I answer your question?
I'm just wondering because with the officer's conclusion here may be a factual issue, wouldn't it, as to his further actions in the stop and whether further testing is offered?
Yes, I mean a police officer was unique in this particular case. So Trooper Utes was unique in this particular case, being both an expert and a fact witness. And I think that's what may kind of cloud the hypotheticals to an extent. But in terms of like a medical examiner being able to testify about, you know, that somebody died of a particular, for a particular reason, and that satisfying an element, that is obviously acceptable. I think one point I can address your question, Judge Hutton, is that the jury was not at the scene. And appellant repeatedly points out in her briefing, the video and audio recordings did not capture everything that happened there. This is, of course, logical because so many little things that contribute to a person's observations, the tone, the eye contact, the mood, those aren't necessarily captured on the recordings. And this is why courts, this court, reviewing courts, pay such deference to the findings and determinations made by the fact finders. And the jury was also obviously unfamiliar with the inner workings of a data master. They had not regularly used it. They did not know how much air volume is required for it or how easy it actually is to use. Thus, whether the defendant's, whether appellant's conduct throughout the trooper's interactions with her constituted a refusal was not necessarily a question that was within the knowledge and experience of the jury, which again, it kind of goes to the heart of appellant's argument and what Moore was saying is inadmissible. It's another distinction between this
Mr.
case
Petras,
and Moore.
The prosecutor have asked the trooper, do you believe it was Ms. Williams' intent to refuse under the law?
I wouldn't have advised the prosecutor to do that, and she didn't. So
apparently there are limits into what you can give an opinion on under 704.
There definitely are limits. I will say there, but that I guess that limit was not reached, or that line was not crossed in this particular case. Kind of going to the two instances in which the trooper testified about the intent of appellant and Judge Bradfield. If I could just finish two sentences, I see that my time just elapsed.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Both of those responses, both of the times that the trooper used the word intent or intention when describing what he personally observed, the questions themselves that came from the prosecutor did not have the word intent in them. And so the way that appellant has chosen to frame the argument as being plain prosecutorial error, the word intent was not included in the question. That is what the trooper ultimately testified to when describing what he personally observed, but those were not embedded in the questions that the prosecutor asked. And I've gone over my time. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court still has, but I realize that the floor is no longer mine.
Judge Bradfield, may I ask one more question?
Go right ahead, Judge.
All right. You know, should we be analyzing this issue under the direct evidence standard of review or under circumstantial evidence? Standard.
The only sufficiency claim that I believe was raised was with respect to the probable cause element, which we haven't talked about yet. As far as I can tell in the briefing, appellant has not challenged the sufficiency to establish intent. I mean, so with respect to whether which direct or circumstantial standard review should apply to a sufficiency claim with probable cause, I think Stark answers that question it being direct. And I try to make that argument in my brief. And I think maybe looking at the prejudice or substantial rights prong of the plain error test, if that's what your question was getting at, Judge Hutton, I don't see any reason to be different than how Stark explains.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And with that, I think we're ready to turn to rebuttal. I'm going to ask the marshal to add 2 minutes to your time. Ms. Jax, if you want to use it, you can, just to make sure we have things as even as possible.
You're muted.
Just a second, Ms. Jack.
Yep. Sorry about that. I appreciate
okay.
that. I'll just start where we finished off there with Judge Conley's question about can an officer give an opinion as to the defendant's mens rea? And the answer is absolutely not. And I'll read you the quote from State versus Bauer cited in respondent's brief on that exact point. The determination of the requisite mens rea should be left to the jury. That opinion as to that point doesn't come in. Bauer is an intentional murder case. In that case, the court, the Supreme Court was very clear that a witness cannot give an opinion that the defendant had the requisite mens rea, intent to kill, in a murder case. Similarly, here, where the mens rea is an actual unwillingness to submit or an intent to frustrate, a witness, officer or trooper Ute, was not permitted to give his opinion on that point. And to Mr. Petras's point that, well, he didn't say actual unwillingness to submit. He said she didn't, that she had the intent. That's exactly what happened in Bauer. The element for intentional murder is the intent to cause the death of another. The expert didn't give an opinion that the defendant had the intent to cause the death of another. The officer gave the opinion that the defendant had the intent to kill. The question is whether what the witness says embraces that ultimate question. It did in Bauer, it does here. As to Noel, and that goes to the...
Oh, before you go to Noel, counsel, so I heard Mr. Petras to argue that one of the points we should consider is the, since this is being raised as a prosecutorial misconduct argument, is whether the prosecutor's questions specifically elicited intent. And he argued that they did not, and you heard that. So what's your response to that?
With respect to the refusal element, there's no question that the information was elicited by leading questions. So for instance, on page 263, the question is this considered a test refusal under the inaudible provided by law? That's a question. And presumably inaudible is definition. So the prosecutor is expressly asking whether or not, in the trooper's opinion,
struggle with that example for the reason that Judge Hooten alluded to. I think I understand this is right, but maybe I'm wrong. The officer does have a duty to determine whether this is a test refusal. So whether to continue to offer the test or whether to stop offering the test. I think that's the way the statutory scheme works. So isn't that question appropriate in light of the officer's duties?
No, it's not, because what the officer testified to was, in order to have in order to determine whether there's a refusal, you look to whether or not two adequate samples were provided. And the officer testified to all that here. The officer didn't need to go one step further. The officer said, I offered the first test. The machine spit out a reading. The reading was deficient. Therefore, I did not offer a second test. Why does the officer have to tell the jury precisely what they're supposed to determine? It's the jury that's supposed to, in the end, make that determination. And again, I think with this opinion evidence issue, one of the problems is that the state is once again not acknowledging that the actus reus and the mens rea are two separate elements. The jury had to find both of those. They had to find the refusal and they had to find the actual unwillingness. So there's two different points in which the officer told the jury that Ms. Williams intended not to submit. And that would be on page 265. The officer said, Ms. Williams had no intention of providing any breath sample to me. That's his opinion, that she was actually unwilling to submit to testing. The other one, I believe, is on page 256. It's on page 199. I don't think she had any intention of providing a breath test. That was improper. And just as with the instruction issue, the state has failed to make any argument that she wasn't prejudiced by that. And that's because the record shows that she was. It was a contested issue.
Well, the state does make an argument and makes it in a footnote. I think that's more precisely. You're saying a footnote weighs
yes.
the argument.
Yes,
right?
And we cited authority that indicates that that's insufficient. Mm-hmm. I will say that there really is no argument to make because the record here is pretty clear for all the reasons I said. The instruction, the elimination of the element affected her substantial rights. Here to this opinion evidence did. I do want to. Oh, go
ahead, Ms. Jacks. Can I just ask you this? Because I know you make on the sufficiency of the evidence. You make the argument that we have to do it under the circumstantial evidence standard of review. And one question I have, and I know you've argued that she testified that she wasn't intending to refuse the test, and she wasn't trying to do anything. And there were statements made at the scene that she said she was trying. But to the extent, even if we use that circumstantial evidence test, the jury obviously in reaching its verdict did not find that testimony credible.
That's right, so. Judge Houghton. That's right. And I will clarify for you that we aren't making that sufficiency argument with respect to element 5. We're making that argument with respect to element 1. So element 1, whether or not the reasonable officer would have had probable cause to believe she was under the influence of alcohol, that particular piece of evidence doesn't go to that element.
All right. Very good. Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, I see my time has run. Judge Bratfeld, may I conclude?
You may.
We would just ask that because Ms. Williams was denied a fair trial, that this case be reversed and remanded for a new one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both lawyers in this case. This matter has been well briefed and well argued.